When I was 18, my dad began dating the woman with whom he'd spend most of the remainder of his life. 6 months into their relationship, her eldest son died when he was hit by a car. At his funeral, the body was placed in an open casket. And I remember my dad telling me how helpful he found this. You could see that his soul wasn't there anymore, he said to me. He wasn't there. Our sermon this morning is about bodies and souls. We'll be asking questions such as these. What is the mind? Is it the same thing as the soul? How is mind related to the functioning of the brain? How do bodies and minds interact more generally? What happens to the soul at death? Does the soul perish along with the body, or does the soul survive the death of the body? Is belief in the soul's immortality biblical? How does it sit along that great Bible theme of the resurrection of the dead? Our fundamental question is this: of what does the human being most basically consist? A body and a soul, or just a body? Now, today's topic is a strange one for two reasons, I think. In the first place, it's going to feel at times quite abstract and disconcertingly removed from the central concerns of the Bible writers themselves. And it's certainly true that when working out what the Bible teaches concerning the soul generally, what we have to do is draw out what a particular passage implies or assumes, rather than being able to simply read off an author's understanding of the soul just from the passage itself. And yet, the question of souls is intimately bound up with one of life's deepest experiences, sitting at the deathbed of someone you love and thinking, where do they go? In the second place, reading about how Christians have thought about the soul over the centuries is really to be faced with the fact that Christians, who have exactly the same understanding of the gospel as you and me and each other, those truths central to who Jesus is and what he came to do, can and have in fact believed wildly different things concerning what the soul is. This morning we're going to begin somewhat counterintuitively, not with the Bible, but with the understanding of the soul as it developed in ancient Greece, focusing in on the soul as it's described in Plato's Phaedo and Aristotle's On the Soul. We're then going to turn to the Bible passages we've just had read for us by Kevin and ask, what do these passages imply or assume regarding the nature of the soul and how it relates to the body? We're then going to look at Gregory of Nyssa's dialogue on the soul and the resurrection to see how one early Christian thought to think through this topic, both biblically and in dialogue with the intellectual culture of his own day. And then we're going to finish by jumping forward into the 20th century and asking whether advances in neurobiology have made belief in the soul redundant, and how Christians today might like to integrate biblical views about the human being with recent developments in brain science. So that's all we're doing today. Right. Part one, the nature of the soul in Plato and Aristotle. Now, the first thing to say here is that the ancient Greeks produced many different theories about the human person, including materialism, which is probably the dominant view today. But the reason we're going to focus in on Plato and Aristotle is simply because of the preponderant influence they've exerted, and continue to exert, actually, on Christian thinking about the soul and the body. Plato's Phaedo is a dialogue set during the final hours of the life of Socrates, Plato's teacher. In the Phaedo, Plato revisits Socrates' last conversation with his friends prior to drinking the hemlock that would kill him. Plato shows Socrates movingly consoling his friends by teaching them about the immortality of the soul. For Socrates, the body is the soul's outer garment. The soul itself belongs to eternity. It lives in the body as in a prison. Death is not to be feared, but to be welcomed as a friend. Aristotle's conception of the soul is quite different. Now, Aristotle was the pupil of Plato, and he was also the teacher of Alexander the Great. And for Hume, the soul provides the form of the body. The soul is an ordering principle. It gives shape to the raw matter of which our bodies consist. The body exists for the sake of the soul, but souls are also dependent upon bodies for gathering the information they need to direct the whole person towards proper flourishing. So if for Plato, the real you is your soul, for Aristotle, the true self is best thought of as a composite of body and soul. Okay, keep that all in mind as we head into part two, soul and body in the Bible. We come now to this morning's readings, and we're going to ask the same question we asked of Plato and Aristotle, namely, what does the human person consist of? Our first passage came from Ecclesiastes. The preacher, most likely picking up on the language of Genesis 1 through to 3, thinks of human beings as bodies shaped from the dust into which God breathes life. As in Psalm 104, when God withdraws his breath or spirit, they die and return to the dust from which they came. Now, the teacher's position is not that the human being is annihilated on death. Rather, he's expressing uncertainty as to the ultimate resting place of the human spirit which survives the death of the body. Does it go down into the earth, or does it rise upward? Nonetheless, death is far from being pictured as a release from the prison house of the body as it is in Plato. Rather, death reinforces our similarity to the animals and humbles us under the judgment of God. Now, the brief passage from Job that Kevin read for us seems to push in a different direction. Here, Job appears to expect something like a resurrection body in which he'll see God, who will vindicate him against the false accusations of his friends in the end. To borrow a phrase from N.T. Wright, he looks forward to a life after death. But there are two significant problems with this interpretation. The first is that this picture runs counter to the teaching of the rest of the book, in which Job thinks of his post-mortem existence in Sheol, basically with a sense of relief, and as a place where he'll finally be free of the persecuting wrath of God, which he experiences in his present fleshly body. The second problem is that these verses present multiple difficulties for the translator, which is why you'll notice that in your modern Bible, there's like lots and lots of footnotes between verses 25 and 26. Typically, Bible scholars date the emergence of a strong hope for personal resurrection to the very end of the Old Testament period, achieving dominance only in the apocryphal and pseudepigraphic literature written between the close of the Old Testament canon and the writing of the New. Nonetheless, it's important to see that even in the absence of a strong resurrection hope, Old Testament beliefs about life after death presuppose some form of body-mind dualism. But notice the contrast with Plato. Death might be considered a release for someone like Job, whose body is racked with suffering, but in general, body and soul are meant to go together. It's an impoverished self that survives the death of the body in Sheol. Death enters the world as a result of sin, and far from being perceived as a friend, is thought of as humanity's great enemy. Turning to the New Testament, we see at once that a great change has come over what God's people expect to have happen to them after their death. In common with most first century Judaism, the writers of the New Testament look forward to a general resurrection of all people at the end of the age, in which the souls of those who have died will be reunited with their bodies. The righteous will live an embodied life with God, while the wicked will suffer punishment again in the body for what they've done during their life on earth. Now, this is the picture that's presupposed by Jesus' parable of Lazarus and the rich man, a picture that he and his listeners would have had in common. Now, the second and major difference, of course, between the writers of the New Testament and those of the Old is their conviction that Jesus Christ has already been raised from the dead as the first fruits of the general resurrection to come. And this means that in contrast to the worldview implicit in Ecclesiastes and Job, Sheol is no longer thought of simply as a place under the earth where the souls of the dead live out a shadowy existence after the decay of their earthly bodies, but is instead thought of as a place where souls await the resurrection of their bodies. And as in the Hades of the Greeks, the Hebrew Sheol is given a more elaborate geography. The righteous dead dwell in the bosom of Abraham, as Jesus puts it in his parable, while the wicked dead experience, even as they await reunion with their recreated bodies, a foretaste of the suffering to come. That's the worldview that underlies the first of our New Testament readings. For we know, writes Paul, that if the earthly tent we live in is destroyed, we have a building from God, an eternal house in heaven not built by human hands. Meanwhile, we groan, longing to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling, because when we are clothed, we will not be found naked. For while we are in this tent, we groan and are burdened, because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up in life. The earthly tent referred to by Paul is his physical, mortal body. The body encloses Paul's soul, much as a tent encases the hiker who spends the night deep in the woods. Just as a tent will eventually show signs of wear and tear, so the human body gradually, or all at once, in the case of Paul, comes apart. The eternal house in heaven is Paul's resurrection body. When we die, we take off our mortal body, much as we might strip off our clothes at the end of the day, but this nakedness or bodiliness of the soul is, in contrast to Plato, an undesirable state of affairs. And this is in part what makes the prospect of death so terrible. Our souls are meant to be housed in bodies. Being without a body is unnatural. So the focus of Paul's hope is for his heavenly dwelling, his resurrection body, with which he expects his soul to be clothed at the end of the age. Now, this is a complex passage, and you'll note that the key interpretative move that I've made here is to say that Paul's heavenly dwelling is the resurrection body he expects to receive from God at the end of the age. And in my view, Paul speaks of it as already existing in heaven as a way of emphasising its indestructibility and the certainty of his receiving it on the last day, not because he expects to jump into it seamlessly at the moment of his death. Now, this isn't the only way of understanding those verses, but I think it's the best one because I think it makes the most overall sense of Paul's teaching about the resurrection in both 1 and 2 Corinthians. But what about the interval of time that will elapse between Paul's death and his receipt of a resurrection body at the end of the age, the nakedness that he speaks of in 2 Corinthians 5? Well, elsewhere in his letters, Paul develops two pictures that speak to this state. On the one hand, he can describe it, as he does in 1 Thessalonians, as sleep. On the other hand, he can talk of it as being with the Lord, as he does in Philippians. Now, again, my own view is that Paul uses the language of sleep metaphorically to emphasize the fact that the death of the body is not the end of the story for Christians. Rather, just as we wake from sleep, substantially the same as we were when we went to bed, so in the resurrection we will be recognizably ourselves. Albeit the glory of our resurrection bodies will far outshine the splendor of the ones we now have. And I then take much more literally the language of being with the Lord from Philippians 1. At death, I think, our souls will dwell with heaven with Jesus. We'll be conscious, we'll be with God as we await the resurrection body that God will give us on the last day when Jesus returns to earth and the last judgment takes place. This brings us quite naturally to the fourth of our readings for today, Jesus' instruction to his disciples not to be afraid of those who kill the body but cannot kill the soul, but rather to be afraid of the one who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Jesus has been warning his disciples that they're going to face heated opposition when announcing that the kingdom of heaven has come near. And again, just as in 2 Corinthians 5, where Paul is really teaching about the resurrection and beliefs about the soul only surface implicitly as he unfolds his argument, Jesus here is really teaching about the reality of final judgment and accountability to God against the backdrop of earthly persecution. But nonetheless, for our purposes, it's worth asking the question, what view of the soul does Jesus' teaching imply? Jesus seems to be in continuity with the rest of the Bible in saying that human beings consist of body and soul, and that the soul survives the death of the mortal body. What he adds, though, is that the soul does not possess immortality of itself, but is able to be destroyed by God in hell. And this is one of those passages in the New Testament that seem to picture hell not as a place of everlasting torment, but as one of annihilation. But I do want to acknowledge that there are passages in the New Testament that point in both directions. Part 3, body and soul in Gregory of Nyssa. Okay, the question I want to broach now is this. What happens when a biblically literate Christian wants to set out his Christian beliefs about the soul in the context of a wider culture deeply indebted to the thinking of Plato and Aristotle? Happily, we have just such an example in the person of the 4th century theologian Gregory of Nyssa. At some point after the death of his brother Basil, himself an important theologian, Gregory wrote a dialogue entitled On the Soul and the Resurrection. The dialogue begins with Gregory himself, laid low by the news of his brother Basil's death, arriving at the house of their sister, Macrina, seeking consolation. But as he approaches her, he notices that she too is showing the signs of a mortal illness. And the ensuing dialogue consists of a composed and relaxed Macrina teaching a distraught Gregory about the nature of the soul and the resurrection hope of the Christian, much as Plato depicted the condemned Socrates consoling his friends on the eve of his death. Now, On the Soul and the Resurrection is a fascinating text because in it we can see biblical passages being consciously brought into conversation with key Platonic and Aristotelian doctrines concerning the soul. Sometimes, as you would expect, a commitment to scripture means explicitly repudiating part of the intellectual furniture of the surrounding culture. Gregory, for example, rejects Plato's belief in the transmigration of souls, or what we would call reincarnation. Sometimes, however, an idea from Plato has captured Gregory's imagination and leads him arguably to accommodate the Christian faith to his surrounding culture in what we would think of as an illegitimate way. For example, there's a passage in Plato's Phaedo where Socrates speaks about the sorrow that souls who've immersed themselves in worldly cares experience when they're separated from their bodies at death. And Gregory develops this in a fascinating direction, arguing that God will use suffering to purify souls of their worldly attachments after death in what seems to be an anticipation of the medieval idea of purgatory. Now, most Protestant Christians, of course, are going to find Gregory's position just not well enough founded in scripture on the one hand, and on the other hand, just possibly compromising Jesus' finished work on the cross. And so I think they're going to be a little bit skeptical of Gregory's argument at that point. Gregory's dialogue on the soul and the resurrection, however, will be inspiring for any Christian who thinks it's important to integrate her faith with everything else she holds to be true. It explains belief in the resurrection for a pagan culture steeped in the language of Plato and Aristotle, at the same time as showing Christians how to bring their faith into conversation with the best non-Christian thought in their surrounding culture. That brings us to part 4, body and mind in the context of 20th and 21st century neurobiology. We now come to the last part of this sermon, and here we're going to be asking, don't recent scientific advances in the understanding of the brain make belief in the soul redundant? If everything that used to be thought of as part of the soul can now be located in different parts of the brain, well, what consequences will that have for traditional language about the soul? Now, the first thing I need to do here is to confess that I am way out of my area of expertise. I tapped out of science at the end of year 10. I wouldn't recognize a neuron if I fell over it. But even for me, neuroscience does shape the way I view and even experience the world. So I'm going to give you, as an example, the 40 milligrams of fluoxetine that I take every day. I take it to inhibit my body's overzealous reabsorption of serotonin. But this has very practical effects in my life. So for example, this week, I've had kids at home sick for 2 of the 3 days that I would normally be spending writing this sermon. Now, the me that doesn't take fluoxetine does not write a sermon this week. It doesn't happen. The me that does can. In my case, disabling anxiety about writing, which is a malady of the soul if ever there was one, turns out to have a distinctly physiological basis. Weird. But even those of us who are less personally indebted to advances in neuroscience in their own lives have only to read through a book such as Oliver Sacks' The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat to see the intimate links between brain function and self-consciousness, or mind, which in this last section of today's sermon I'm going to be treating as basically equivalent to the word soul. Now, Sacks' book is a great read, and it's full of moving depictions of men and women forced to reconstruct their sense of self in the wake of significant brain injuries. Bodies and souls turn out to be far more intimately intertwined than we might previously have thought. How might scientifically trained Christians bring their scientific training into conversation with cherished Christian beliefs about the nature of the soul? I'm going to give you three options. The first option might be to eschew belief in the soul altogether and become what is called a Christian physicalist. That is, someone who remains committed to the gospel, committed to the resurrection of the dead, but who thinks that the Christian faith can be articulated without recourse to belief in a non-material soul. Now, such a Christian has a few things up her sleeve. She's going to be able to point out that the basic New Testament hope for believers is the resurrection of the body, not the immortality of the soul. She'll also be able to point to the way that both Old and New Testament writers think of mind and body far more holistically than they typically are thought about in more platonically influenced Christian writing. But she is going to have more difficulty speaking about an intermediate state, that period of time that elapses between the individual's own physical death and the general resurrection. One solution for her might be to say that the intermediate state forms part of the intellectual background to the New Testament writings, in much the same way, actually, as the three-storied universe forms part of the intellectual background to the Old Testament doctrine of creation. Now, just as Christian believers have wished to retain the doctrine of creation, very important, while adopting a view of the earth as spherical, and you can see this as early as writers like Gregory of Nyssa, for example, so too they can distance themselves from belief in an intermediate state, which, after all, looms so much larger in the intertestamental literature than in the New Testament itself. A Christian physicalist might want to say that the Christian's mind is destroyed along with her body at death, but that God will recreate both at Jesus' return. That's option one. A second option would be to retain belief in the soul's survival of the body and in the intermediate state. Now, this option is going to be attractive to Christians who think that the scattered biblical references to an intermediate state of souls awaiting their resurrection bodies amounts to something more than a culturally bound background to biblical resurrection faith, and who think that actually going to be with Jesus when you die and await your resurrection body is itself an important part of Christian hope. And these people will acknowledge that while many, if not all, the activities we associate with mind appear to be enabled by the brain, the soul nevertheless is something distinct from the brain, and that God will maintain it after the death of our body so as to ensure that the self who inhabits our resurrection body is recognisably the same as the one that once dwelt in our earthly body. That's option two. There's also a third option, which is to view mind as an emergent property of the different functions of the brain as they develop through interaction with the surrounding world. Even though the soul, on this view, emerges purely out of the physical configuration of the brain, once it exists, the mind does enjoy a relative independence from the body so as to be able to survive the destruction of the body at death. And this option is going to be attractive for Christians who want to pay more than lip service to the insights of contemporary neuroscience, but who also wish to uphold a traditional Christian understanding of the intermediate state. The drawback to this view, I think, is that I think it's going to have difficulty in recognising the existence of a mind or self in people who fall outside the range of normal human development, such as children who die in their mother's womb, for example. I think that might be a problem with this view. Now, while working out which of these options is going to provide the best way forward, it's also important to step back and to look at what the doctrine of the intermediate state is trying to protect. Now, as far as I can see, over and above the obvious function of capturing and systematising the various allusions to it in the New Testament, the doctrine of the intermediate state is trying to ensure that the you who will live forever with Christ at his return is in a meaningful way the same you that lives together in your mortal body. Much as the doctrine of the resurrection body is designed to account for a meaningful continuity between your weak mortal body and the glorious transformed body that you'll inhabit at Jesus' return. Now, the basic argument of this sermon, I suppose, has been that the resurrection of the body and the immortality of the soul need not be seen as competing doctrines, but as mutually supportive ones, provided that the latter is shorn of a Platonic view of the body as something bad in itself. But more important still is the way that today's passages, and others like them, speak to God's faithfulness, not just to his creation as a whole, mind-blowing as that is, but to the individuals who form part of it, to you, to me, now, and at the moment of our deaths.